Welcome to Energy in Action. I'm your host, Marcy Young, and as a Mito patient myself, I appreciate you and the community you've helped us to build. This podcast honors the triumphs and struggles of patients and families affected by this disease and celebrates the work being done by doctors and researchers every day to make it a safer world for our people. We are a support group and a podcast focusing on all things related to mitochondrial disease. Today, I am joined by our Energy in Action friend, Dr. Mark. He has provided such excellent wisdom, nuggets of truth in relation to such, you know, daily life topics. And I love the way he talks to our audience. He is so intelligent, but he speaks so well to, you know, the everyday person. And it's a great quality. I'm so glad to have him here. Today we are talking about everything related to sleep. Dr. Mark, welcome back.
Thanks. My pleasure.
I am so happy to have you here. This is a topic that I have wanted to speak to a physician about since I took on this podcast. And it's an interesting topic to talk about and one that's really top of mind for our population. So I think before we talk about like the mitochondrial disease population and sleep, I think we should just talk about sleep.
Yeah.
So why, I guess let's start really at the basic. Why does our body need sleep? I think that would be a good refresher for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, nobody knows exactly, but we know that if you don't sleep, you die. So there's a very rare disorder where people get fatal insomnia, where you just can't sleep. So we know that it's important for restoration of our body. Like we have, you know, summer when things grow and winter when things rest, you know, our bodies go through periods where we're active and we're using our mitochondria and doing activity, which is, you know, during the day when you're up and about moving. And then at night when you're synthesizing. So in our body, we have two, you know, it's very simplistic, but there's two main processes. One is called AMP kinase, which gets activated when we exercise and we're doing activity and turns on mitochondria. And then we have mTOR, which turns on synthesis of proteins. So it's sort of that rest, relaxation, the rebuilding, the rejuvenation that occurs at night, and then getting ready for the next day so that we can start burning more energy. And if you're not allowing that rest, then as everyone experiences, you know, one night of poor sleep, it really impacts you. At first, we really didn't know, you know, why are you tired? Part of it is likely directly related to the mitochondria. Recent research has shown that worms, flies, mice, humans, we all have essentially this link between what's called our circadian rhythm, where we're alert and awake, and then we go to sleep, and then we're alert and we're awake. That's our circadian rhythm. And that's linked to the mitochondria through a set of genes called CLOCK genes, C-L-O-C-K as the name implies, and these directly relate to mitochondria. So when we age with flies, mice, worms, rats, humans, our circadian rhythm gets thrown off and our sleep cycle is affected, and that indirectly affects our mitochondria. So for all of the people out there who are able-bodied, don't have mitochondrial disease, you still could mess up your mitochondria with aging and with poor sleep. You know, aging we can't do much about other than good exercise and good nutrition, but sleep, you know, is something we forget about and we think, oh, you know, I just have to do it, but we don't really think of it as important as exercise or nutrition, but it's actually probably more important to optimize our sleep.
That's a very good answer. So I've always wondered, you know, you say even like one poor night of sleep can make someone very tired. Is catching up on sleep a myth? Can you catch up on sleep? Or is it better to get back to your healthy habits of sleeping?
You know, trying to get back onto a healthy habit of sleeping is probably the easiest thing to do and, you know, likely the most effective thing to do. On the flip side, you know, there is evidence that if people oversleep, you know, that actually is associated with negative health consequences as well. So, you know, the numbers, people debate them back and forth, but, you know, ideally you should be sort of 7 to 9. When you start getting more than 10, you know, it's associated with more negative health consequences. So too little is the most common thing we see, or poor quality, you know, but there is a sort of an oversleeping, which is not good for people. Although sometimes people oversleep because of other disease processes, like myotonic muscular dystrophy, we see it. And so, you know, that probably pulls that negative relationship between having too much sleep. But I think at the end of the day, the quality, which we'll talk about, is one of the most important things in addition to the quantity, which, you know, sort of that 7 to 9 is kind of what you want to shoot for.
Yeah. So I guess it's everything in moderation, like everything else, right?
Yeah.
I, you know, as someone with a mitochondrial disease, my sweet spot, which I don't get very often, is like 9.5. But do you think, like what you said just a minute ago about, because there's another health consequence playing into the situation, do you think that maybe I there's less chance of other, or let me rephrase, that it's not that I might not be experiencing other health ramifications if I do get extra sleep, but it is also beneficial for me to get the 9.5 hours of sleep because of the condition I'm facing?
Yeah, I think that everyone's different. Able-bodied people, people with disease, everyone's, you know, totally different. Some people are the night owls. Some people like to go to bed early. Yeah. Some people, you know, for a while, I was living on 5 hours sleep for decades, which not good. But, you know, I think it, at the extremes, you know, we say the sort of 7 to 9 window. But, you know, if you're at 10, you know, I wouldn't worry about it. If you're getting up to 11 or 12 hours of sleep,
no,
you know, clearly something
that
going
I can't
on.
Do.
Yeah, no, I think for most people, it would be hard to have quality sleep for that long, and that would be the issue. But I think really the quality, if you're somewhere between, you know, 7 to 9 hours, again, everyone's a little different. You know, there's some evidence that getting that sleep at the, before midnight is an important component. Part of that is
why?
You want to get into the deeper stage of sleep, the stage 3 and stage 4 sleep, when a bomb can go off and you don't wake up. That's really an important deep state to get into, which allows some of these restorative processes to occur. What's nice for folks as well is there's many things. There's an Oura ring, there's different watches, which can actually track your sleep. And, you know, we'll talk about some recommendations to improve your sleep, but it's nice to actually measure it. You know, if you go to a respirologist, you breathe into a machine, you measure it. Come to see us. We put people on a strength device. We measure the strength. And then we can see, are there improvements or not? Much the way that we can do step counts, you know, duration of exercise, heart rate. We can also track sleep now with so many of these amazing sleep tracking devices. So to get a better idea of what's going on. And sometimes you're surprised, you know, things that you do during the day actually improve the quality of sleep. And then, you know, you can incorporate those into your life.
Oh, that's so interesting. So what kinds of things during the day could improve your quality of sleep?
There's a number of things. There's a whole bunch of things that can mess up sleep. The most common is caffeine. Caffeine, absolutely. You know, and even these crazy people, like, you know, one of the professors I'm going to meet soon, we meet at the end of the day, I have a decaf. He'll have a full caffeinated coffee. He says, I'm Italian, I can drink whatever I want. Probably, I think he would see that if he has coffee, you know, at 6 or 7, he probably doesn't have the best sleep compared to not having caffeine. Caffeine has a half-life of about 5.5 hours. So if you think about that, if you have with dinner a full cup of coffee, you know, that's going to make you more alert and it's not going to, you know, wash out of your body until probably the next morning. So that's the biggest thing that we find is people taking caffeinated products too late in the day. Again, everyone's a little more sensitive and there's factors like birth control pills and their inter-individual differences and in medications which can affect the caffeine half-life. But to a first approximation, you know, remember that 5.5 to 6 hour rule? That's sort of when you lost 50% of the caffeine you've consumed. So if you are sensitive, don't drink much after, you know, 12 or 2 in the afternoon so that most of it's out of your system when you go to sleep. That's one. Number two, you know, everyone knows I'm the world's biggest supporter of exercise, kind of addicted to it myself, and we know it's good for all of our patients when done properly. But for some people, exercising in the evening can sort of perk you up. Because exercise is fight or flight, turn on that sympathetic nervous system, that sort of AMP kinase versus restore. Sleep is restore. It's let's chill out. Let's, you know, turn the lights out. Let's rest. Let's let the body recover. And if you've just worked out, you know, you're probably going to be a little bit hyped up for a couple of hours afterwards. And certainly, you know, I try to do my exercise in the morning. I think, you know, later on in the day is fine, but not after in the evening for most people. That's going to probably mess up your sleep. So those are some things in the day that are probably the biggest negative influencers on your sleep. Things you can't control. Obviously, everyone knows this. When you're under more stress, you know, and you wake up at 2 in the morning to go to the washroom, or you just wake up to roll over and, you know, a small stressor during the day becomes catastrophic in the middle of the night. Not much you can do about that other than mindfulness and, you know, trying to deal with these issues. Other things that really mess up your sleep that you do during the day is too much screen time. Because if you think about it, you know, our body follows day, night, and at night we don't have light. So light coming into our eyes wakes us up. And so if we're looking at, you know, these dumb, crazy things that people, you know, bring to their bedroom and their you know, staring at it or watching TV before they go to bed, that actually wakes up your brain because the light's coming in and it's saying, come on, guys, let's wake up. It's morning time. So what you want to do is to minimize the use of this and watching TV at least an hour before you go to bed. So those are some of the things during the day that I think are, have the biggest negative impact on sleep. But there's things you can do to also improve the quality of your sleep. One of them, I think, is make sure if you can that your bed is proper. Everyone is different. I've had beds that just are horrible. I've had beds that I really enjoy, beds that are too hot, too cold. You know, it's like the three bears. So try out different beds. You know, if you're going shopping to in Canada, we have a place called Sleep Country. It doesn't matter where you go. Try out different mattresses. My wife and I, for example, have different foam pads. I like mine a little firmer. She likes hers a little softer. So those are important because if your mattress is too firm, you roll over on your shoulder and the pain wakes you up. That's not good. So, you know, play around, talk to a sleep expert to get the right kind of bed, you know, and play around with different firmness. There are now new beds, too, that allow a bit more ventilation because people like me tend to be furnaces at night and you get hot and sweaty. And so having a more of a ventilated mattress is better. In terms of the sheets, even the sheets make a difference. I've got sheets up north that have a high thread count that are more linen. I love them. I sleep like a baby. You know, those thinner, slippery sheets. Oh my gosh, I can't sleep at all on them. So proper bed, proper sheets, and proper pillow. What type of sleeper are you? Do you sleep on your back, your side, or your front? Every pillow is different. Every person is different in terms of how they sleep, and your pillow should reflect that. So again, if you're a side sleeper, your pillow might need to be a little bit thicker so that your head isn't flopped over. If you sleep on your tummy, you want a very thin pillow. So all of those things, again, talk to a sleep expert at a sleep store. So, you know, if you go to Walmart and you just pick up some garbage there, it's worth the effort. Sleep's so important. You know, put a little bit of effort into it to get the proper pillow, the proper sheets, the proper bed. And then other things, just a tiny little thing like my phone at night, you see how that came on when I moved it? That light sometimes with notifications, if that light comes on in the middle of the night, that's going to wake you up. Put your damn
phone.
That
has happened to me. It's crazy.
It's the biggest thing is going to mess up your sleep.
Yeah.
So I keep telling my wife, and she's a physician. Unfortunately, she's on call sometimes and has to keep the dumb phone.
But right.
I say, look, yeah, we're going to have to sleep in separate bedrooms or we're going to get divorced. Put the damn phone downstairs and shut it off. So a phone waking you up, so shut the ringer off if you have to have the phone, if you're on call or whatever, but put it face down so that when the little light comes on every once in a while, it's not waking you up.
Right.
And with that, it's light. So on your clock as well, we've got a clock at our main house where we work, and it's really bright. So I have a Economist magazine that I put over it at night, because that light in the middle of the night will wake me up. So you want it dark. And the reason why you want it dark, as I say, is, you know, when we were, you know, evolving as, you know, lizards and, you know, we had light sensors in the top of our head to wake us up. We have light sensors in our brain, which is called the pineal gland. So when light comes into our eyes, goes to the pineal gland, and that wakes us up, shuts down melatonin. At night, when the light decreases, we release melatonin, helps us sleep, and then we get into the whole sleep cycle. So light is your biggest thing that's going to mess up your sleep. Shades on your windows when you're going to sleep, right temperature, low light, all of those things are really important to improve the quality of your sleep.
Mm-hmm. A lot of what you've just said, it really resonates with me. You know, the once in a blue moon where I leave my phone face up versus face down, it does wake me up in the middle of the night, you know, or my bathroom attached to my room lets in a lot of light. So if I don't close that door, it lets in a lot of light. And I definitely sleep better when I remember to close that door. It's such simple things to think about. Yeah. It doesn't cost me any money, nothing. And it can really lead to a better night's sleep. I'm very much in agreement with you. One time I was charging something on the other side of the room and the light saying that it was fully charged was so bright in the middle of the night. And it ruined my sleep that night. I guess I'm very sensitive to those things, or maybe everyone is. But even thinking about, you know, specifically the mitochondrial disease community, it really would behoove most or all of us to, as you said, not go to Walmart, but go to a real sleep store, a mattress store, and talk about how you sleep, what you need, what you're finding as you sleep, so that you can get the proper equipment supplies, you know. I've noticed that if I'm not comfortable when I sleep, I can have my back never feels good, but you know, it could feel worse if I have a bad night's sleep, you know.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Or at a hotel could affect it. Obviously that's out of your control, you know, what bed they have, but those types of things are really crucial.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. And other little tricks, like I really don't like my knees touching. It wakes me up.
Oh yeah.
And so putting a pillow between my knees, it also stabilizes your back a little bit. So I just bring this up because of your low back pain. I've got some back issues. And if my knees are apart, it keeps your pelvis, because if you think about it, your pelvis is where my palms and my hands are here. If I have my knees touching, it puts more torque on them. If it's straight, mm-hmm. everything's in alignment. So having a pillow here between your knees, if you imagine these are my knees, that keeps everything in better alignment. So that's another little trick that some people find helpful.
My physical therapist would really like that comment, right? That was one of the first things I learned from them when I started going, you know, years and years ago. And I haven't, sometimes I'll send, if I'm not sleeping at home, I'll literally bring extra pillows, you know, or a body pillow. I love a good body pillow. It really keeps me stable. And I think without the tossing and turning, it leads to a better night's sleep.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And
it
along those lines,
it keeps me in one
too.
Spot.
Mm-hmm. Along those lines, we talked about light and your eyes mm-hmm. waking you up. The other thing is hearing. You know, if you think about it, if we're evolving, you know, to 350,000 years ago and you're in a cave sleeping and a saber-toothed tiger comes in, you're going to be dead if you don't wake up. You're not going to see it, but you're going to hear it. And hearing is another thing. I make fun of myself, say to my wife, if a mouse farts next door, I wake up. So I'm very, very sound sensitive. So I often put in earplugs because, you know, if my wife snores or, you know, there's some beep on the darn phone downstairs or whatever, that also will wake me up. So I do find I get a much better sleep if I put earplugs in. She says the same because, you know, I know I snore now more than I did when I was young, which then gets to another point is, are you sleeping with somebody or not? Because if you're sleeping with someone, you know, often they're tossing and turning, they're mm-hmm. snoring, whatever. But if snoring's an issue, put earplugs in. It makes a huge difference, you know, from that perspective.
I use white noise earplugs, like sleep buds. Do you just use plugs or are you using sleep buds?
No, I just
what do
use
you think of
plugs.
Both options?
Yeah, whatever works for you. You know, I tried the
Do you think
white
I'm
noise.
Damaging my brain?
I don't think so.
Okay.
But, you know, I just don't like the white noise things.
They yeah.
That's because I hear the white noise and the white noise keeps me up. You know, if I just put the little foam plugs in, and if, you know, it's an ongoing thing because your partner snores, you know, get custom made ones. They're going to be more comfortable. Mm-hmm. And the ones that you buy at Home Depot and you put in, they'll only last two or three times. And then the sponge will expand too quickly.
Yeah.
You can't get it in your ear, so you won't get yeah. a good deal.
Yeah. We've spoken on previous episodes about the importance of creatine. Is creatine something that you recommend taking earlier in the day, or does it not affect sleep?
No, it won't affect your
okay.
sleep. You know, there are some studies that there are benefits, you know, and that's usually with sleep deprivation. So the studies show that with creatine supplementation, you know, if you think about soldiers who are going out on a mission, this is where they've mm-hmm. sort of started to think about this, or people that, you know, pilots or whatever, you know, the cognitive tasks after a few poor nights of sleep are better if you're on creatine. So there is definitely some benefit from creatine in the sleep deprived situation. Our goal is to make sure everyone has better sleep, but, you know, no matter what good intentions, you'll sometimes have crappy sleep. And there is some evidence that the creatine will allow you to function a little better cognitively after poor sleep.
Okay. That's really interesting to hear about, because I typically try to take it in the morning, and I've gotten a lot better about taking it regularly ever since we recorded our last podcast together. But I typically do late morning, and I do put in like yogurt as you taught us. But then sometimes if I have a bad night's sleep, I wonder, oh, should I have taken it earlier in the morning? Could this be affecting me? So it's good to hear that that's probably not the case.
The one thing that can affect people, in addition, I should have brought this up, to the caffeine, is if you have a really huge meal too late. So
okay. If
you have protein and fat, it can be up to 5 hours before you digest it. So let's
wow.
say you're eating a big meal at 7, mm-hmm. you want to go to bed at 10. It's only 3 hours later, you're still, you know, digesting. And, you know, that can give people heartburn, and it can sometimes keep people up. Certainly, really large amounts of meat at dinner can affect your sleep. It's, you know, and I don't know the biology behind it, but they call it the meat sweats.
I've heard of that.
Yeah. And, you know, I've certainly had it. Like, you know, you get all excited on a Friday night, you're going to go on a date night and you go to a steakhouse and you have a big, huge steak. And then you have the worst sleep of your night afterwards, you know, and part of that, I think, is probably just because you've taken on so much fat and protein that you're still heavily in the process of digesting. You're also more likely to get a bit of reflux if you've taken on so much because the food's still in your stomach and then you go and lie down.
Yeah, as you're trying it's a bad combo.
Empty your stomach. It's not a great combo. Then the final thing is alcohol. You know, a lot of people think, oh, I'm trashed. You know, I'm going to drink myself to sleep. I mean, hopefully people don't do that, but, you know, maybe you have a glass of wine or a beer. One or two is probably not bad for most people, but, you know, certainly again, that Friday night, you go to a date night, you might split a bottle of wine with your partner, and then you think you're going to sleep well. Not only it's the high protein and fat, the alcohol is also probably negatively contributing to that sleep. It helps you to get to sleep, but it doesn't keep you into that in that deep sleep. It also increases the risk of reflux. So what that is, you know, when you're munching up your food with all that acid, it's supposed to go into your intestine. But if it goes back up through a sphincter here at the bottom of our esophagus, it can burn and cause some discomfort. That feels like almost a heart attack because your esophagus is almost being burnt by the acid. That can wake you up, and that's pretty uncomfortable as well.
Very uncomfortable. Totally hear you. This is all such good advice. What about sleep aids? There's so many out there, and I feel like more and more of my friends and family members are using them. I mean, the list goes on. Melatonin, Xanax, other products labeled sleep aid, marijuana.
Yeah, that's it. It's an excellent, excellent point, and there are a lot out there because so many people don't have good sleep. The issue is if you don't follow all those simple things that we talked about, it doesn't matter what you do, you're not going to have great sleep. So you got to start with the simple things. Problem is everyone wants a quick fix, you know, this peptide crap and, you know, people cheating in sports and, you know, doing performance enhancing drugs. You got to put the time and effort in to sport performance. You got to put the time and effort into healthy lifespan, and you got to put the time and effort into proper sleep. So doing all that stuff up front, there still are people who, you know, in spite of all everything we've talked about, might have issues. So I would say start with what's safe and start with what's simple and what's logical. So the first thing would be, you know, something like chamomile tea. Make sure you don't have caffeine. Make sure that you're, you know, some people, I remember we had a nanny decades ago who thought green tea was decaffeinated. Green tea definitely has caffeine in it. So make sure that there's no caffeine in your tea. Chamomile tea, you know, might help some people. That might be enough. One thing that we're, you know, big fans of, especially in children who with certain mitochondrial diseases, their sleep-wake cycle gets messed up, is melatonin. Mm-hmm. And the reason why we're a fan of melatonin is that's what your pineal gland releases when it's dark to tell you to go to sleep. So I think melatonin is always a good first step. And again, okay. I was at a UMDF meeting about 20 years ago, and I don't know where this went, but there was a person who put in a grant application and showed some nice antioxidant benefits of melatonin. So I thought, wow, this is great. You know, we have a brain in some patients who are sensitive with mitochondrial disease. Now we have a natural antioxidant and one that improves the quality of sleep, and it's natural. So, you know, we usually start 1, 3, 5, and 10 milligrams. So that would be sort of the dose, take it an hour before you go to bed and, you know, ramp up. If you get to 10, it does nothing for you. Don't keep taking it. But, you know, I would start generally 1, 3, 5, and 10 practically. Mm-hmm. There's a 1 milligram, a 3 milligram, a 5, and then you can take 2 fives as a 10. So that would be, you know, the next, I think, safest thing if you wanted a sleep aid. Some of the over-counter medications, a patient asked me about one yesterday. Turns out it's an antihistamine called Benadryl. So people are probably familiar with antihistamines. Like I have allergies when I was a kid. All we had was the sedating ones. So you go to school, you know, crashed because you take a Benadryl before you go to school when you're in grade 2 and you wonder why you're failing math because you're sleeping through it. So again, that's what many of these sleep aids are. They're just an antihistamine. That's the older sedating type like Benadryl. You know, I don't know if people want to be on Benadryl for the rest of their life. So I'm not a huge fan, but if, you know, you're going through a tough period, that might be reasonable. You know, there's other things, you know, L-theanine, a few others that are out there. Again, some evidence for some of these other natural supplements, not strong, but, you know, there's some evidence. I would probably try some of these first before you jump to medications. I'm not a huge fan of medications because I think they're a temporizing measure, and most people haven't looked at all the other things first. In the old days, it was such a huge thing to go on what are called benzodiazepines, things like Xanax, which you mentioned. I've never prescribed that in my life for sleep because, you know, people get addicted to them, hard to get off of them. And it doesn't really improve the quality of sleep. It'll get you to sleep, but it won't get you into that stage three and stage four sleep.
Oh, okay.
You know, the one that we do prescribe if somebody has, let's say, migraine headaches frequently, if they've got, you know, other chronic pain scenarios is amitriptyline. We've used low-dose amitriptyline because it is a muscle relaxant. There is some evidence that it lowers migraine headache frequency, and it's non-addictive, so you can stop it if you don't like it. So that's one if, you know, I was going to a medication because people have significant sleep would be the amitriptyline. And there's other ones like nortriptyline, which are similar, but we usually use like 10 milligrams, 20 milligrams. Not much more than that. So those would be the things to think about. Now, the other important thing from a medical perspective is to make sure that there's no medical conditions which need treating. Number one, very important, is restless leg syndrome. So restless leg syndrome is this weird feeling that you want to tighten up and move your legs, which can keep people up at night, massively impair your sleep. If someone has restless leg syndrome, check for iron deficiency. So low ferritin is important. So you want it over 50, and you know some sleep clinics say over 100. Bottom line is many females are like 10 or 8 low iron stores. Not only does that increase the risk of restless leg syndrome, it also is not good for your mitochondria. So everyone thinks, well, who cares about low iron stores as long as your hemoglobin's normal? Well, that's not accurate, because iron is important for the iron sulfur clusters in the mitochondria. So getting that ferritin up over 50, and ideally if you can, which is hard for most women to get it over 100, that would be important. And I would say every mitochondrial patient should have their ferritin levels checked, and the goal would be over 50. And that's going to help with restless leg syndrome. If restless leg syndrome is severe, then, you know, talking to your neurologist or sleep specialist, there's other things that people can take. Sinemet, which is a drug for Parkinson's disease, other dopamine agonists, in Canada we call it Mirapex. Some of those type of medications can help with restless legs. Nocturnal myoclonus, that's also something that we see probably more common with Murph syndrome. And that's where you suddenly get jumps like this. Now, we're all going to get those once in a while, but if those are constantly happening to you, and you know, through your neurologist, you might want to try clonazepam to decrease those myoclonic jerks. And that would be the only instance, I think, where I would think it's appropriate to take a benzodiazepine specifically for nocturnal myoclonus. And then finally, sleep apnea. So, you know, if your partner snores so loud, actually, I've got a good buddy I've trained with for 40 years, and we go to his cottage and we sleep in the bedroom, my wife and I beside him, you can feel the wall shaking, he's snoring so bad. I don't know how his wife does. It's absolutely insane. But clearly he should, you know, be on a CPAP machine for sleep apnea. Again, I think, you know, if people are really having problems sleeping, you know, trial the things that we talked about, but also consider getting a sleep study to make sure that you don't have sleep apnea and need a CPAP machine. And for some patients, like I saw a lovely 54-year-old lady yesterday who has Milas syndrome. She didn't know it at the time. She actually came to me because she was intubated and she had slowly progressive weakness and diaphragmatic weakness and couldn't breathe. So she actually came in, had a cold and was on a ventilator. And we made the diagnosis of Milas syndrome from hearing loss and droopy eyelids and high lactate that wouldn't come down. So the worst scenario, which can impact your sleep, is that if you're not breathing enough at night and you start to retain carbon dioxide, you're going to be tired and sleepy in the morning with a headache when you first get up. So those are all medical conditions which need treatment. So we've started from the usual, the typical things that you can do. And most of us have crappy sleep. How can we improve it? All the way up to, you know, very severe medical conditions which need treatment, but they can be treated. Diaphragm weakness, BiPAP, sleep apnea, CPAP. There's lots of things that can be done.
So it seems like if one is having a difficult time sleeping or waking up not refreshed, then that person should give it some thought throughout the day. How can they make better decisions that will impact their sleep? And that's things that they do throughout the day, their bed setup, medicine they take. And again, if there is possibly a health issue that is creating a bad night of sleep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think going through all of those steps, I think, you know, my guess would be, and certainly our experience, 95% of people, we can significantly improve the quality of their sleep. But sometimes you can take the horse to water, you can't make him drink. So we give people all of these advice.
And, so true. You know, so true.
And we are sensitive to finances as well. Some of the things like going to a good quality store mattress to buy an expensive mattress might not be, but you know, even still, I think, you know, people can have low cost options that, that still can improve their quality of sleep.
Right. Even just avoiding alcohol and, you know, high amounts of protein at night, you know, and I wanted to ask about napping. So do you think that it deters someone from getting a good night's sleep at nighttime? Do you, I've always heard like if you nap, you should do a 20-minute power nap or, you know, something like that. What are your thoughts on napping? And especially for the mitochondrial disease community.
Yeah, I think first and foremost, you know, if you nap, does it mess up your sleep at night?
Yeah.
Your sleep at night is your priority. And not that you shouldn't rest and, you know, but there's other ways of resting without actually falling asleep. You know, often when we are on the couch, I'll watch, you know, Tour de France or whatever. My wife falls asleep because she can't stand it. I'm resting, but I'm watching the Tour de France, but I'm not sleeping. If I sleep for more than 15, 20 minutes during the day, even if I've done a 2 or 3 hour run, if I sleep more than 20 minutes, my night is totally pooched. So,
really?
You know, everyone's a little different, but I would say try if you're going to have a nap, no more than one and, you know, probably not more than 15, 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
There is some evidence if you're sleeping an hour during the day, that's going to mess up your sleep at night for sure. Again, everyone's a little different. My wife can sleep a little longer than I can without messing up her sleep. If I'm more than 20 minutes, my night is going to be horrible.
Mm-hmm. I come from the perspective of I really don't want to ever mess up that overnight sleep. I want to be able to get those, you know, stage 3, stage 4 minutes of good sleep. So I get nervous, even if I'm really tired during the day, I do try to rest. I mean, I rest every day, but I try not to sleep because then I know I'll get so angry with myself that I've napped and then ruined the overnight, you know? It's such a battle. So let's talk about waking up refreshed. So I wake up many times a week, still very, very tired. And my husband and I talk a lot about it because, you know, we're trying to decide, is it because, just because, or is it because I have this disease? And my husband says, sometimes I wake up and I'm still tired too. You know, is it more common for someone with mitochondrial disease to wake up and not feel refreshed, to feel like, I mean, sometimes I feel like I could go back to bed for another night.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough one. You know, it's difficult for me because I don't think I've awakened refreshed for 42 years. So, you know, I think
maybe it's not isolated to the mitochondrial, you know, community.
I think it's so hard to know. Yeah, I think number one is, you know, there might be one or two things I've said, or maybe 3 or 4 things that I've said that people didn't really think about. All of those little things, if I wake up refreshed in the morning, I usually can identify there was something. It was that stupid phone that went off, or the light came on, or my wife was snoring and I forgot to put earplugs in, or God knows what. There's always some explanation. But once in a while, it's the voodoo of life, I call it, where, you know, shit happens, you wake up and you're just tired. But I think, you know, just reflect on all of the things that you could do to try and improve it. And, you know, that's kind of the best you can do, and don't beat yourself up over it. But, you know, try not to take long naps during the day. I think that's a big factor in screwing up your sleep at night, like you say. But yeah, I think that's all I can say. I wonder when I retire, will I ever wake up, you know, not trashed in the morning? But whatever, it's tough.
This is an interesting topic, you know, and it affects everyone so differently. But I think really giving it some thought beyond, you know, the everyday, you know, frustration of it all, but really taking a step back and thinking, okay, there are some things I could do that don't cost a lot of money, that just take a few minutes of thought so that I can better my night's sleep and hopefully then better my daytimes as well, right? So before I let you go and go see patients, I know you have so much on your plate every day. I appreciate you spending so much time with us on the podcast, but I'm curious, in your paper that I read prior to this and we'll include in your show notes, I think everyone could really benefit from learning so much more at a more, you know, in-depth level. The paper is called Sleep and Your Mitochondrial Health, Restoring Your Battery. So within this paper, you talk about the vicious yin-yang cycle where sleep impairs mitochondrial function while mitochondrial dysfunction can impair sleep. Can you kind of give us a little elevator speech on on what you mean by this and how it all works?
Yeah, again, it gets back to those clock genes. You know, they are linked to the mitochondria. If the mitochondria aren't working properly, like, you know, as we age, for example, I'm a big fan of aging as a mitochondrial disease that we all have. You know, pretty much all of the 12, you know, key factors with aging can relate back to the mitochondria not working. And like I say, from Drosophila to, you know, Drosophila are little flies that we use in research. Worms are called nematodes, mice, rats, humans. You know, the mitochondrial dysfunction occurs, sleep also gets messed up. You know, what comes first? Is it chicken or the egg?
Right.
Is it the mitochondria and then poor sleep? And then the poor sleep impairs the mitochondria and it becomes a vicious cycle. I think what we need to do is to, you know, do the best we can to break the cycle. You know, we all are getting older from the time we're born. We are aging. Yeah. And so what can we do? All of the things we talked about with exercise, proper nutrition, and then, you know, sleep is the third part of that, is that restore and recovery. We've got to optimize that to try and do our best to mitigate these issues. So I think, you know, as we talked about before with proper exercise and nutrition, and then this is the third part of that trifecta to try and optimize what we can control. That's about all we can do to optimize our health. And that goes for all of us. I mean, I'm an old guy now. My mitochondria are crapping out. I'm doing all the stuff we're talking about. I've learned from my mitochondrial patients. I do it all. I take a mitochondrial cocktail. I've exercised for 40 years. I really am starting to think about my sleep. And what I would say, if you can afford it, an Oura Ring or one of the watches that can measure sleep, learn about the sleep, record it, and then try some of the things. Not everything that we say works for everyone. And even when you see a study and they say, oh, this is the bomb.com, remember that studies work on averages. There are responders, non-responders, you know, 60, 70% of people might respond to any strategy. So if one works for you, that's great. If it doesn't work for you, don't, you know, beat yourself up, move on to try something else. Because there's, I think we've talked about probably 30 things that people can do today in this podcast. Some of those hopefully are going to work for you.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Mark. This is a topic that I just think is so pinnacle. And I'm glad that we had really the smartest guy on the block here to talk about it with us. So thank you. And hopefully we will have you again on the podcast. Thanks for all of your wisdom. And we'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye. Have a good night's sleep, everyone.
Thank you for joining us. I encourage you to browse other Energy in Action podcast episodes. I am so inspired by the resilience of those in previous episodes, and I know you will be too.